got a troubled mind. Wash it out and hang it up on a clothing line, and the sun will shine.
Hey everybody, welcome to the Science Facts and Fallacies podcast brought to you by the Genetic Literacy Project. I'm your host, Cameron English.
And I'm your co-host, Kevin Folta, a professor who cares about science communication.
This is the weekly show where we discuss the biggest stories from the Genetic Literacy Project to keep you informed about groundbreaking developments from the worlds of science and medicine, and of course, to help you separate facts from fallacies as you read the headlines. Hello everybody, welcome back to the show. Cameron and Kevin here, as always. Kevin, what's up, my friend?
Another week, another good podcast coming up. I really like doing this, and we record this at the end of the week, right? And this is kind of like a nice punctuation mark on the week. I always look forward to this.
I agree. That's the best way to put it, too. It's sort of like it has a very Friday feel to it, this show. It's like, oh, the end of the week's here. We get to do this fun thing, and then I don't have to do nothing for 2 days. So there you go.
Oh, you don't have to do anything for 2 days. Well, you loan your kid to somebody, or you...
I was just telling Kevin when we were getting into our little room here to record that my kid figured out how to pull the cable into the camera over his bed. So if he doesn't want to sleep, he rolls around and he goes, I think I'll pull on this. Why not? What could go wrong? So I have to do the show. And as I'm doing the show, I have to make sure he doesn't bonk himself in the face with a little baby monitor. So fingers crossed while we do this. But with that out of the way, let's jump into our stories for the week. So first up, loneliness shown to triple risk of dementia. Next, let food be thy medicine, how GMO tomatoes could help Parkinson's patients. And finally, the Sovietizing of Western science, conflating STEM research with fashionable ideologies raises Orwellian concerns. First up, Kevin, loneliness and dementia. I think we talked about this probably a month ago, at least the possibility of this, I think.
Yeah, we touched on this, and this was just kind of reinforcing. It seems to be a really strong association. Granted, it's not the world's biggest study, but it's a good example of how social interaction may be very important in our long-term brain health. And it's probably reinforced very much by the fact that the data that show that married couples seem to live longer and surprisingly be happier. This whole study was based upon data that came from the Framingham study, which is this large prospective cohort that started in 1948. And that as you follow people through life, you're able to do certain tests along the way. And now that group is moving into their elderly time, you're able to look at the data and ask questions about lifestyle and diet and whatever else, and then start to draw conclusions between various components. So are you lonely? Okay, some people said yes. And in that group of lonely folks, a higher percentage of them had reported dementia compared to the non-lonely group. And it shows, in essence, that it could be a very important part. A social interaction is an important part of keeping our brains healthy and keeping our brains active.
So I want to get into, we can get into some of the epidemiological details in a second, but I'm curious about how they think this might happen. I know they didn't demonstrate a mechanism, but I read in the study, they said something to the effect of your brain treats loneliness like a dangerous state, and it triggers your sympathetic nervous system, which causes inflammation. And this might be how loneliness contributes to an increased risk of dementia. Can you explain a few of the details for someone who doesn't know what that means?
Well, I'm not exactly sure either, other than it suggests, and this was just a hypothesis, that when you're alone and out of a social context, like, you know, shut-ins and folks like that, that the body does have a response to that. And the response to being alone is an enhanced amount of inflammation. And inflammation is, you know, a very general term for a physiological state where certain blood chemistries are elevated, certain responses are in place, and can contribute to or have been shown to associate with long-term degenerative disease. So that's kind of the hypothesis. How they would test that, I don't know, but it's probably one of the better explanations to explain it.
Yeah, I don't doubt that it's true. Maybe the right way to think of this study is, if this is true, this is what you would expect to see. But this kind of study can't conclusively tell you, oh yeah, loneliness definitely causes this. And I think they've actually mentioned in the discussion section, they said loneliness might just coincide with the onset of dementia, which might itself, one of the results of that or symptoms that would be loneliness. So it's very difficult to disentangle.
Yeah. So you're exactly right. It says as much that loneliness causes dementia as it does dementia causes loneliness. And maybe people don't want to be around the dementia person. I don't, that's kind of the reverse mechanism, right?
Right.
Much more mundane explanation. But I think this is what that basically says is, if we accept that hypothesis and support for that, it's kind of, there's not much you can do about it. But if loneliness led to dementia, it is something we could do something about, especially for those of us who have an elderly parent or, who's alone most of the time. How do you develop social networks? How do you encourage or build social networks for them? And can social media help with this? And this is another interesting part of this, is that it wasn't observed in older folks, like over 80. This was observed in the 59 to 79 age demographic. So this was younger type of their survey, younger folks of their survey, who were demonstrating this association between loneliness and dementia. Older folks, they didn't have this.
Let's talk about that social media aspect. I wonder how that works. Maybe it's because they are isolated and they're older. So any kind of interaction, even if it's online, would be helpful. Because I've seen, it's not conclusive, but I've also seen some research that shows, at least in younger cohorts, people feel more isolated and more depressed as a result of social media exposure. So what do you think about that? Is that what they're getting at? Like, just interacting with anybody online, if you're in your mid or late 70s, is better than nothing?
It's hard to say exactly what that means, but I would say that any kind of interaction is good. I mean, even a phone call is a real step forward for some folks who are isolated. And having the interaction with others is important because it uses a different part of the brain versus if you're just staring at a television or listening to a radio. So having two-way conversation, having interaction is something that will give a little exercise to the brain differently than simply being a receiver of information. So I do think there may be something to that.
Well, maybe one day there will be a GMO tomato to treat loneliness. But it looks like first, how you like that for a transition? Yeah. Looks like we might be at least relatively close to putting drugs in tomatoes for Parkinson's. So tell us about this.
Well, this is really cool. And this is a story that was in Genetic Literacy Project, Let Food Be Thy Medicine, How GMO Tomatoes Could Help Parkinson's Disease. And this is an article by Felenci Monfiston-Sejour. And this was in GLP February 1 of this year. And I'll say that I was very happy that this got published, because Felenci was one of my former students in molecular biology class. And I really encouraged my class and him especially to do some writing about a topic important to them. And he did this. So, hats off to Felenci. The whole story is really about Parkinson's disease and the very limited number of drugs that have been effectively used to treat it. And Parkinson's disease incidence is increasing. It's not extremely prevalent, but, a few percent anyway of people. And the majority of them see onset between the ages of 50 and 59, and then it normally continues. And it's a pretty devastating disease that slowly robs the victim of their faculties of decreased nerve function. And it's between coordination and balance and so many other factors. My father has Parkinson's disease on top of the other mess he's in. And so it's been something that I've been able to watch from a distance. But the bottom line is that there's two issues with the drugs that are used. And the main one is called L-DOPA. And L-DOPA, well, the actual compound that works in the brain is dopamine. And it's a lack of dopamine, which seems to be at the root of the Parkinson's problem. So can you just put dopamine back in? Well, you can't put dopamine back in because dopamine itself doesn't cross the blood-brain barrier. But there's something that does called L-DOPA, who I always thought would be like the coolest Mexican wrestler, like the L-DOPA, you know, professional wrestling. But L-DOPA could cross the blood-brain barrier. That's, see, now there's his tagline.
Yeah. I'm picturing like a little guy like Rey Mysterio doing backflips off the the top of the ring.
L-DOPA. But so L-DOPA can cross the blood-brain barrier. It's a very similar chemical. And then once inside the brain cells is modified to dopamine. And so this is why it provides some relief. There's two problems, is that there is, with more people with Parkinson's and more demand for the drug, there's less available. With all the weirdo supply chain problems and drugs coming from other countries, there's not a lot of domestic production of L-DOPA. That's one big issue. And the other issue is, what if you're in the developing world and you don't have access to these drugs on a regular basis? And you're seeing an increasing incidence of Parkinson's in other places. So in this case, something like a plant that produces it could be a real step forward.
So tell us about how they actually engineer this tomato. So I believe there's a gene in beets that catalyzes the production of L-DOPA. So you isolate this gene, you breed it into a tomato, and then you eat the tomato, and then you get the benefits of L-DOPA. That's the Reader's Digest, but dive in a little more if you can.
Oh, that's actually it. So the gene itself just performs this catalysis. Plants make L-DOPA. There's a few plants that do it very well. Velvet bean, beet, they have a gene that produces this compound. We don't know what it does in plants. And, you know, it's really hard to say exactly what it may be doing in plants. But the gene does exist. So if you could move this gene that performs this catalysis to something like tomato that produces a product that we eat, could you, in essence, have a BLT and curb the effects of Parkinson's disease? And so this was the hypothesis, and it turns out it works. A group at John Innes, Kathy Martin's group, Kathy's awesome. They did this work by inserting that beet gene into tomato. And they demonstrated very clearly that you can generate a monster amount of L-DOPA inside the fruit. And what's really cool is that now in the developing world where you can't send drugs every week, you might be able to send seeds and have essentially people grow their own treatments for this. And the other important part too that I left out before was that the synthetic versions of the drug, some people don't tolerate well. And I'm not exactly sure why, but I actually got an email recently from somebody who said, are those GMO tomatoes that make the L-DOPA available? Because I have a parent who is not able to take the Parkinson's drugs because they really bother her. Maybe she could eat the tomatoes. And I had to tell her, well, no, they're in England, and the chances of them ever being actually released for use in humans are probably not that good because of the great pushback against genetic engineering. So chalk up another victory for Greenpeace and USRTK.
Hooray. well, that's the obvious question that everybody has is, you just answered it, but maybe we could talk a little bit more about why this would be unlikely. Beyond the concern about genetic engineering, would there be an issue with doing clinical trials to get this approved by an agency like the FDA, or would it be a logistical matter of trying to control who grows the tomatoes and who sells them and, you know, those practical questions? Talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, that's a really good point, because is there a toxicity that you'd have to be careful of? And plants produce different products like, maybe L-DOPA, based not just upon the genetics, but also environmental signals. And so would a well-fertilized, well-watered plant produce enough, and maybe a plant that wasn't so well taken care of not produce enough? Or could you produce or accumulate toxic levels if the fruit overripens or is fertilized too much or gets a little too much boron? Or you can see all the weird problems that are here with when you regulate a drug, you know precisely what's in that pill. When you grow it in a plant, you don't necessarily know. Now, this is water that the cannabis folks have or medical marijuana folks have dealt with for a long time. And, you know, that doesn't seem to be slowing them down any. So maybe this is something that could be realized. But ultimately, I think it's it may be a question of can people essentially grow their own medicines at home and be able to self-administer to be able to control the symptoms. And maybe that's really where this needs to be considered.
Yeah. I also wonder if could you breed a variety that contains a lower dose? And so maybe, like, I don't know if prevention is the right way to look at this, but maybe something that just, like you just said, like manages the symptoms a little better perhaps, or something along those lines. I just don't understand. And I asked you this before about like, it was another drug that one of these farming pH stories we were talking about. Like, would you just go to CVS and you have a prescription and the doctor goes, okay, let me go get your grapes or your tomato or whatever. You know, that's what I wonder about, you know, because this would, if it's a potent pharmaceutical, it would have to be controlled in some way.
Yeah. Or maybe what we can do is open a chain of restaurants for the elderly. It's all early bird specials. We'd be out of there early.
Call it L-Dopa.
No, well, you think about, you know, a number of these kinds of diets and ideas have been thought of over the years, from vaccination to other compounds that could be administered. They just have to survive digestion and find their way to the brain. And that's the big challenge. So you have saturating levels of this stuff. It probably is, probably can't overdose on it. You know, just a, you know, my guess, but long story short, it's another step forward in trying to have a solution for a problem that it may never be able to serve. And maybe that'll change. So let's cross our fingers and look at this as a great breakthrough that'll be ready when society is ready for it.
Right. Right. If the demand's high enough, then we'll figure out all these other issues. But it just doesn't matter, right? They're like, why figure these out if you're not going to have people that are going to buy these, I guess is what it comes down to. Like so many things, I guess we'll see. All right. This final story, Kevin, this Sovietizing of Western science, tell us about it, but I'm particularly interested because you're the academic of the two of us. And so I wonder if you have experience with this at your own university.
Oh, well, there's a reason that we choose these stories. So the story was written by a professor primarily, Anna Krylov, who grew up in the Soviet Union and is a chemistry professor in the States here somewhere. It's in the University of Southern California. And her colleague, Jay Tansman, who's a freelance journalist. And the story basically recounts her experiences in the Soviet Union and how back then, how she was very concerned about, she would see trends that are starting here in the U.S. that were reminiscent of what she would see in historical Soviet style communication of science. So there's a lot of great examples from back in the 8 days of Stalin, where scientists who had very good ideas were told, we're not going to do it that way. And my favorite one might be the story of Nikolai Vavilov, who is one of the greatest botanists of ever. And I mean, just amazing work, beautiful work. And his work was so good. He very much was a fan of Darwinian evolution, which the Soviets were not excited about, because that would say that we're not all equal, that some may be better than others, and that competition can put you ahead. And so that was an idea that they didn't want to emblazon in the brains of people who were under this kind of regime. And so along comes Tofrim Lysenko, who is Vavilov's student at one time, who proposes all kinds of wacky ideas that were much more consistent with ideas of Linnaeus and other stuff, where if a giraffe had to eat leaves high in the tree, that its neck would get a little longer to get there, and that the next generation would somehow inherit that. It wasn't based upon mutations and derived characters, which lent a selective advantage, which is what Darwin suggested. So anyway, the Soviets shut down Vavilov ultimately. He ended up dying in a gulag in his 50s from eating moldy bread flour as his only food he was allowed to eat. And Lysenko took over, and Lysenko pitched a lot of really bad ideas about farming and wheat breeding of wheat, and essentially starved a nation. Probably one of the better examples. Other folks back then, like Karpchenko, who was an outstanding geneticist, the guy was executed for speaking the insanity of genetic segregation. So this is, this is what Soviet science was like for a while. And this article talks about a number of examples like that. And really, that's how this article starts. Are there examples where Orwellian Big Brother type of oversight quashes ideas or writes its own narrative with respect to science?
There's so many examples in the article, like real life examples of things going on today. But the one that caught my attention, it's an undergraduate course at Cornell University. And this is a quote. It's dedicated to exploring the supposed connection between the cosmos and racism. And the class is called Black Holes, Race and the Cosmos. Will be tasked with answering such questions as, is there a connection between the cosmos and the idea of racial blackness? I don't know what to say here, Kevin. This is so obviously and overwhelmingly stupid that, like, there's a major university teaching this. You're not only you a researcher, but you're a teacher. So what's your take on something like that?
Yeah, there's a lot of this going on. So in my university, which the views expressed on this podcast do not represent the views of the University of Florida, faculty, staff, or students. I'm supposed to say that on everything I do because my words are so dangerous. I know, believe me. But that's perfect. But we'll get to this in a minute.
Right,
The courses that are coming out are attempting to be a little more edgy and maybe be a little more provocative, especially around issues of race and social issues, social justice. And I think they get groovy titles to try to suck people in. And it's really someone who probably does have a really good class. And I can't say one way or the other, but I didn't read about the class any further than the article. But, my class that I'm teaching next year is a critical thinking class disguised as technology and science and medicine. But it's all about how do we know good information from bad information. But I know what you're saying. It's part of this article talks about, it comes up all the time. Will I be canceled? And will my ideas be canceled? And her response, so she wrote an article, and I kind of got this thing all backwards. She started out by writing an article about this, and she got great responses where she thought she would be basically shut down and was very happy to receive such good support from academics who felt it appropriate for her to have the views that she does. And really, the rest of this was all about the idea of cancellation and how it's gone too far. And I think she's right on. When you see, we talked about Joe Rogan and the cancellation of Joe Rogan, but you can look at so many other folks where they were basically told by using social media, where the angry mobs were coming after them and taking them out and tarnishing their reputations. But at the same time, their institutions telling them, okay, you quiet now. And it's not what's supposed to happen in academic circles. And I know, from my experience I was told in 2019, shut up. You're a lightning rod. We're tired of the FOIA requests and you stop talking about that science stuff. All right. I had to cancel talks. I had so many things. Horrible. Now I do this all on my own time. And that's how I have to do this as an independent guy, not associated with the university. And it's sad because I should be doing this. Every university should be embracing this kind of work. Anyway, the bottom line is how do we push back against this kind of thing where people are also, well, let me hit one other point. She also talked a lot about self-censoring because nobody wants to go out in the cornfield, right? No one wants to go under the bus. So in order to do that, people are not speaking their mind. So you actually see a curtailing of free speech based upon cancellation because everyone's afraid of being canceled. And that was another huge part of what she was talking about.
Yeah, I think, I don't know if she's talking about specific academics, but they describe this as coward culture. And I think that's what you're getting at with a certain university is that they're so concerned about controversy and they just want everyone to shut up and do their work and everyone goes to school and it's nice and everyone gets along. So they won't push back on this kind of stuff. And it's really crazy because I've had interactions with scientists like privately in email and so forth where, you know, I'll ask them about a topic that like something in genetics. And because there's a potential racial component, like if a certain treatment would work better in one group of people than the other. And before this scientist answered my question, they said, it's almost like they had to cross themselves, like in the name of the Father, Son, and the Holy Spirit, diversity is our strength. And I'm like, it's okay. Like, I'm not going to screenshot this. I want to make sure I have the facts right for a story, you know, but I think that goes to show how far this is gone. Is that even in a private communication, someone felt the need to go, I'm not racist, but here's what my research shows. You know, it's just crazy that we've reached this level.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really sad. And what you find, and a really good point in her article was people stop speaking their mind and talking about their values and what's important to them and what the data say. And they're starting to frame everything in, how does what I'm about to say demonstrate or reject my belonging in the tribe, right? In the social tribe, used in that parlance. So how am I going to get heat from my groups based upon my views? And this has been something that's been talked about in a number of ways around genetic engineering and climate and all the different controversies we have are the people who hold views like, you know, I'm a farmer at the farmer's market, so I need to be into organic farming and I need to, be wearing my Birkenstocks and you got to, you know, wear the uniform and you got to do the whole thing. And ideas that are counter to that can get you kicked out of that tribe. And it's really, that was a bad example in general, but you kind of get the idea, you know, people who say, you know, down my dirt road in rural Florida, you got a Trump sign in your yard and a Confederate flag on the flagpole and you're showing your tribe, your colors. And you probably aren't going to go out and talk about how wonderful it is that they're teaching the black holes class at the university, right? And so there's a lot of this kind of checking yourself to make sure that you fit in the group. And that's something I'm never good at. And I know that the worst thing I ever did was apologize to some of the folks who came after me for different things. Like, oh, no, that isn't what I meant. Or, well, I don't know. Well, don't think of it that way. You know, I should just say, damn right, that's what I said. And I stand by it. So I've gotten a lot better at that with time. But it's because of this situation, as she describes it, this overlording of ideas, controlling ideas that they need to cleanse. And that's really Orwellian.
Yeah, it's awful. And good for you for having the courage to say that, because it'd be one thing if you made a genuine mistake and you needed to say, hey, I'm sorry, I got that wrong. But this is, and I think this is her overarching point, is that they're trying to turn normal speech and normal academic existence into something that's harmful or dangerous unless you say exactly the right things. And the level of absurdity in some of the other examples. So she mentions, it's just in one of the links, but she said that they're trying to rename certain theories in physics. So I clicked on the link, and it's about how what's his name? I told
yeah, the Jewish
Newton. Isaac Newton. They're like, okay, the guy invented calculus. It's like he just our entire understanding of the natural world is revolutionized by this individual's work. And they're saying, well, he benefited from colonialism. So we have to discard his accomplishments. and my thinking on this, and I'm sure other people share this, is that you can recognize that someone grew up in a time when people believed and did abhorrent things. And you could say, well, their academic and scientific work was very good. And obviously it's valid because we've confirmed it over and over again. But maybe they had some weird belief about slavery or something. And we can recognize that we're just going to discard that because that's evil. You know, it seems that we can occupy two thoughts at the same time if we really try.
Yeah, we really, but no one can do that, right? It's if you are not 100% in line with today's version of what your tribe wants you to be, then you are out. And that's it. And if it means that back in the 1700s, your family kept slaves or something, you know, or some famous person was, like we talked about Darwin having some weird womanizing thing going on and thought that would lead to his cancellation. But it's a really sad thing. The thing is, I think it's changing because even the comedians, like folks like Bill Maher have been talking about this and you know, Bill Maher, really a left-wing guy, you know, way out there. And what he's saying is political left, you're taking this too far. And by canceling people for things they couldn't control or for the times they lived or for it just isn't the way to win hearts and minds and works against you in the long run.
Yeah, it's a good point. I do think there's some comedic irony in the fact that it might be people going, we want to make sex jokes. Like those might be the people that save civilization. Yeah. It's like no one else is willing to make, well, there are some, but as a rule, you know, no one's willing to stand up seriously and say, this is idiotic. It's going to be Bill Maher.
Well, when you say that though, you're right though, that if you look at college campuses, comedians will not go on college campuses anymore. Like edgy comedians, because they don't want to get, have a protest outside of the whatever, you know, student union, you know, name your group union, because he makes a joke about whatever, you know, after seeing what happens with Dave Chappelle and so many other folks for trying to be funny about a topic, which comics have always been the social illuminators, right? Around, they've been the ones who could push the edge and make us think about a social issue in a thoughtful way. Maybe to show how something is wrong. Maybe to show how something maybe we should revise our thinking. But right now we don't have the sophistication or the nuance to be able to listen to somebody else's ideas and say, well, where do I really fit on this? Instead, it's how is this going to get me kicked in or out of my tribe?
Yeah. This isn't a new point, but the effect of all of this, it's training up the next generation when they're confronted with ideas they don't agree with or that they've been taught are bad, instead of pushing forward and grappling with it and trying to figure out if these are valid ideas or not, they're being trained to go, well, this idea makes me feel bad. Therefore it must be harmful and I need to be removed from it. It's like the exact opposite of what an education is supposed to be. I sound like such a boomer, but I think that's a very valid point that lots of people who are smarter than I am have made. And that really concerns me because we're getting to a point now where you can't interact with someone like, and we talked about on your, on Talking Biotech a couple months ago about GMOs as colonialism. You know, we literally can't argue with the other side because they think that we are colonizers by arguing that GMOs are not colonialism. So I don't know. The world's crazy is all I can say.
Yeah, that's it. But the last thing you just talked about made some sense. And remember when we've also talked about, referred to Jordan Peterson on this podcast and how, Source Watch has me down as one of his big fans. I don't necessarily like the guy. I don't really think of much about him. But when he was publishing a book recently, he was publishing a book and the publisher who was going to release this book, all of the 20 and 30 year olds in that office said, we don't want to work here anymore. If you publish that book, we're leaving. Or, you know, they basically had walkouts because they had chosen to publish his book. And so now you have the employees running the show rather than the management, because the management is so afraid of the employees. Seems really backwards. And unfortunately, he'll find another publisher, you know, and you know, it's not going to stop him, but it is going to change your relationships at work, because everybody feels empowered and so offended.
It's wild. And I'm not a big fan of his, to be frank. And I think your Kermit impression of him is really, really good, by the way. but he doesn't say anything all that objectionable, you know, like 20 or 30 years ago, the stuff he was saying about, you know, stand up straight and clean your room and, you know, deal with your issues, all that kind of, it's like, okay, well, thanks, mom. You know, it's very, very generic advice, but today it's this radical right wing propaganda. I'm confident that most of the people that supposedly hate him don't know anything about what he says. They've just read, you know, an article in Slate or something, and they're like, okay, well, you know, he must be a jerk because I read it in, you know, this big magazine or whatever.
Right. Yeah. Well, that's a big part of it. A lot of what he said got bent in funny ways because, and this is the only thing I really know about the guy, they really went after him around pronouns. When somebody, there was a question about whether or not the government of Canada should mandate right. You use the pronouns for, I think we talked about this on the podcast way in the beginning, and that for transsexuals or other folks who considered themselves not necessarily binary, that you would have to use the correct pronouns under being called hate speech if you didn't, or being some sort of punishment if you didn't. So you'd be breaking the law. And he says, I'll call anybody what they want, but I don't want it to be a law.
Yeah.
And people took that as transphobic when he was like, I'll call anybody whatever they want. You know, I'm happy to, you know, I'll be happy to call them by whatever they want. he's more like Kermit the Frog.
Yeah.
I'll be happy to call them by whatever they want to be called. Yeah. But that was what people characterized him as, transphobic. So I'm not defending him.
Anyways, I guess we can wrap it up there, Kevin. I think suffice it to say that we both agree that this is all ridiculous and that we're getting to a very dangerous place now, because it's not like 5 or 6 years ago when it was over in the humanities departments. Scientists like yourself could be like, oh, classic humanities. But like now it's in your living room, so to speak, and you really have to grapple with it. And, you know, I don't think it's affected research directly just yet, but it's getting there. Like the next thing is, you know, this study that you want to do, we're not allowed to do this study because it could offend someone.
But let me just jump on that real quick before we wrap it up, is that, you know, there are people I know who work in echelons of upper government, who in funding agencies, things like that, who have told me that you are not allowed to use the word climate or climate change in your, or you're strongly discouraged in any documents that will be used to bring support to the federal agency. So like, you know, DOE, if you're going to be talking about increasing heat and need for electricity, you can't talk about climate change. You can talk about the demand for energy. You know, so it's a real weird thing where this is coming from all sides, and it's all because of politics. It's because of weirdness. And I'm going to be dialing it up and kind of giving my finger to institutions and those who want to shut down this kind of discussion, because we need to be having more of this discussion, not less. Right, I'm done. And those are my two cents.
I like it when we get Kevin all riled up, because you're such a controlled, friendly guy, and you're very much about having a dialogue and, hey man, sit down, let's have a conversation. Tell me what your concerns are. But then today you're like, I got my dukes up. Let's go.
I'm fire. I know. Get off my grass, Aaron. I'm going to be the craziest old man.
Academic freedom is the best. Give me a beer.
Well, yeah, there's, I have a lot of things to say about academic freedom. It's a, it's a wonderful concept. And that, you know, back to that whole silencing. I mean, we talked about Susie, oh gosh, why did
Wiles, right?
Yeah. Wiles, Susie Wiles. I adore Susie. I feel bad. I missed her name. Susie Wiles, you know, how she was getting heat for talking about COVID-19 scientifically. I mean, give me a freaking break. They should be throwing money at her and putting her on a bus and parading her around the world to stomp her combat boots and say, this is the way it is, you idiots, because she gets it right. And she just, I mean, we need more of academics in that space and we need to be encouraging it. Instead, they're shutting it down. I'm done.
Yeah. Now I'm really done. Okay. All right. Well, before you're done for the week, who are you following on Twitter?
Yeah. Please go on Twitter and follow the guy that wrote the article about tomatoes. His name is Filenci, and it's spelled like this. It's at Filenci. And then followed with MS. So Filenci MS on Twitter. And he has medical school aspirations. He's a really, really sharp guy. I would love for him to have lots of followers so that he gets more excited about communicating science and makes that a big part of his medical school application. I think it'll really help him. So go ahead and follow Filenci. What about you?
Well, while Kevin's trying to build up the careers of his students, I'm going to recommend that you follow a fast food restaurant. And I think you recommended Steak'em once before.
Oh, yeah.
They've been killing it on Twitter again. So the one I just saw says, it's insane how many people in the world just sit in different rooms tapping glass rectangles with their thumbs and somehow end up getting mad at each other. I love that. Because I'm just as guilty of it as anyone else, you know, just sitting in my office and I read something and I'm like, oh man, what a moron. And then I think about that meme of someone shouting at their neighbor and they're like, someone on the internet's wrong. I can't come to the barbecue. I have to.
Well, anybody out there who wants to hire someone to do this job, I'm available. You know, the Steak'em guy, I think it's a guy, and the dude who used to work at TSA on Instagram were two of the most hysterical, funny, poignant, the guy at TSA, he passed away last year and their replacement is good, but not as good as the old one. But that kind of social media is so powerful and has a way to rein it in. So when you have a flat meat product, who is the guiding light of social media, it says that we're in end times.
Yeah, I think that's right. The world's probably close to its end.
It was predicted in the book of Revelation, I think, that.
Yeah, true facts. Yeah, it's in the last chapter they talk about when Steak'em is your vanguard of truth, you're all screwed. Anyways, it's at @steak_UMM, Steak'em. I love that. Well, you guys have a terrific rest of your week. Thank you so much for listening to the show. As always, you can follow us online at Kevin Folta, and my writing is at ACSH.org, and my website is CameronJEnglish.net. We will see you next time.